You're listening to Something Beautiful, part of the Emergent Podcast Network. For more information about this and other great shows, visit us online at www.emergentpodcast.com.
Hey guys, this is Andy Weir from Broxburn near Edinburgh in Scotland. I hope you're doing well. Just a quick bit of feedback. I caught up on some of my favourite podcasts while I was washing the car the other day, and yeah, a bit concerned really about the abuse that you were dishing out there, Stuart and Thomas, about drummers. I'm shocked and somewhat appalled, given, you know, that the first instrument was a drum, that you would be quite so disparaging to that. However, I'm more than willing to extend the olive branch of peace, and if you guys fancy doing some kind of drum circle action, then we can, you know, we can have a bit of fun and take it from there. Anyway, enjoying the podcast, particularly enjoyed the Pernell Goodyear interviews recently, although I will confess that I was a little bit disturbed once again by the visual imagery that Thomas was sharing of him sitting in his kilt with no underwear. That's just quite unnecessary. I mean, really, there could be children listening to this, and that's just dangerous. Anyway, guys, keep up the good show, and I'll speak to you soon. Cheers, bye.
When the dollar made with blood is spent, when an enemy can't become a friend, when the bitter man won't lend a hand, baby, this is how the world will end. When the day of war is a rarity, or a diplomat hasn't time to see, when a child lost is a true offense, baby, this is how the world will end. Bring a chair up to the table, bring a message to the crowd. Where's a common trust to deliver us from the wretched and the proud? Sing a tune about the promise, speak on that which we depend. And if a certain light don't shine again, baby, this is how the world will end.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, today on the phone with me, we have the Soup Man of Dallas, David Timothy. His website and blog is soupmobile.org. He's also the author of the book, Is God on Vacation?, which is available through Amazon.com. David, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Well, thank you, sir. My pleasure to be here.
Tell us briefly, for people that may not be familiar with the Soup Man, especially those outside the Dallas area, tell us a little bit about who you are.
Well, I run a charity here in Dallas called the Soup Mobile, and we serve food to the homeless. But the key to what we're doing is we're a mobile soup kitchen. So unlike regular soup kitchens where the homeless come to you, because we're mobile, we go to the homeless. Mm-hmm. And as part of our operation over the years, I've earned the name from the homeless, and they call me the Soup Man. And I do run the Soup Mobile.
Okay. Well, now, tell us a little bit. I mean, growing up, were you – I'm assuming you weren't homeless. I mean – I'm not sure of your whole story background, but where did you grow up? What was that like?
Well, you're correct. I was never homeless myself.
Okay.
I grew up in and lived most of my life in the Detroit, Michigan area. But even though I wasn't homeless, I grew up in a household where food was scarce. And as a child, I experienced hunger firsthand. And not just the hunger. Along with the hunger goes fear. Hmm. And the fear is that you won't get the next meal. The next meal won't be there. So it goes way beyond just the normal hunger pains. It's a fear that goes with it. So even though I was never homeless myself, that hunger I suffered as a child has given me a real compassion and empathy for the homeless who literally struggle to find food every single day.
I see. Now, were your parents together? Were they split up? Or was there some economic situation that kind of led you into hunger?
Well, in the early years, but my parents were, I think, married until I was about 10 years old.
And okay.
They got divorced. But even when they were together, it was just tough economic times.
Mm-hmm.
And food, again, was just very scarce. And that's just one of those memories that sticks with you through life. And it stuck with me, but it's turned out to be a real blessing. Because, again, it's given me this really strong compassion for the homeless as they struggle to find food.
Okay. Now, was God in the picture as you were growing up?
Well, he was, but not in the traditional sense where we were. I mean, we went to church, but it wasn't a type of thing where it was a strong connection. It was more we just went to church, and then we came home, and that was pretty much the end of it. I wouldn't say it was really a strong connection at all.
Oh, okay. So what kind of, I know your book is God on Vacation, and I know that you take some of your things and some of your processes from a faith standpoint. What kind of turned things around where you became interested in God or where you started making those connections?
Well, I think the big change occurred for me is when I married my late wife back in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
When we were engaged and planning to get married and had set the date, she already had a very strong relationship with the Lord. And, of course, she recognized early on that I did not. And it wasn't a deal breaker for her as far as whether she's going to marry me or not. But she was very patient and very kind about telling me more about the Lord and telling me things that as a child, even going to church, I just hadn't really been aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And that she was really the one that was responsible for starting to turn me. Not so much that I was running from the Lord before. It was more of I just didn't know what it was all about, and I really just didn't get it. She was very patient with me and really helped me bring me along in that area.
Okay. Now, I know a lot of people will say that it's things in their childhood, different events that they look back and that kind of turned them off, turned them off from God. Was the poverty and the hunger, did that affect you in any way, or was it just kind of two completely separate issues?
I think it was two separate issues here.
Okay.
The poverty and the hunger were clearly pretty scary things and not easy. I don't think it was ever a situation where I said, geez, I'm running from God. It was just, I just wasn't making the connection with him until my late wife kind of steered me in the right direction.
Okay. And what was that final turning point for you?
Well, a couple of months before we got married, and she'd been talking to me right along during our engagement about it, but a couple of months before we got married, she just came to me one day and she said, David, she said, you know, we've been talking about this for a while, she said, you know, we're getting married in a couple of months, and she said, no matter what you tell me here, what your answer is, we're still getting married. She said, but, you know, have you made a decision? How do you feel about it? And I said, I just can't think of any reason not to come on board.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm with you in this concept of accepting Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior. And I said, I'm all for it. I said, what do I do? And she said, well, let me lead you to this this prayer. And she led me through the Savior prayer. And that was it. That was the turnaround right there.
Oh, good. Very good. Well, how did you get then from the Detroit area down to sunny, warm Dallas, where it's probably 50 degrees out today?
Well, what a journey that was. What really brought us eventually to Dallas was seeking treatment for my late wife. Literally within days of our marriage, she became sick. And
mm-hmm.
Ultimately, we found out that she had been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
Mm.
And so for the next 15 years, we literally became nomads, traveling the United States looking for a cure for her multiple sclerosis, because as you probably know, there is no known cure. But I wasn't willing to accept that. And so we traveled to different states. So we had a motorhome and literally looking for whatever was the latest treatment available for multiple sclerosis. And if we stayed in an area that seemed to be showing some success for my wife, and then we would stay there for a while. And if it wasn't, then we'd move somewhere else where we'd heard about another treatment.
Mm.
And towards the end of her life, towards the end of this 15 years, that's when we heard about Dallas. Dallas has one of the top multiple sclerosis centers in the country, and almost as a last resort, we came here to get her treatment, and the treatment unfortunately wasn't successful, and she passed away. But after she passed away, we'd already been in Dallas for several years, and I had to make a decision: do I stay here in Dallas, or do I go back to Detroit, where virtually everybody I knew was?
Mm-hmm.
And I decided that I would stay and to start this soup kitchen called the Soupmobile, and I've never regretted it. Dallas has just been a wonderful place for me to be, and that's how I got to Dallas through this 15-year nomad journey that where we finally ended up here.
So that was, I guess, right around 2004, 2005 that you came to Dallas?
Well, we actually got to Dallas in late 2001.
Okay.
My wife passed away in late 2004.
Okay.
So we've been here a couple of years with getting her the treatment from the on her multiple sclerosis before she passed away.
Okay. So was the soup kitchen then somewhat, I guess, in response to her passing as well?
Well, kind of a combination. Actually, in the year before she passed, we actually started the Soupmobile on just a very tiny basis, just a little bit of feeding the homeless, not really anything. It really is after she passed away that it really took off. And part of that was just a simple function of I needed something to
mm-hmm.
do.
Mm-hmm.
After she passed away, I was just lost. And the Soupmobile, in many ways, was a savior for me because it, as I immediately started to expand its operation after her passing, it just kept me really busy and occupied and doing what we think is a good thing, helping these people.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, it's just grown steadily every year since.
Mm-hmm. I know that for me and for other people that I've talked to, that my sister passed away in 2005, I guess probably shortly after your wife passed away.
Oh, okay.
And, for me, service is one of those things that anytime I start feeling down or anytime I'm, feeling like, oh, woe is me, getting out and actually serving others just completely remedies that. And it really just helps me focus on the much bigger picture rather than just getting down in the dumps like it's so easy to do.
Yeah, I think clearly doing something in a service capacity, whenever we're facing difficult times, the benefits are just enormous. I know for me it was, obviously it was for you.
Mm-hmm.
Some people think, oh, well, geez, you're grieving, you can't do anything, but I think the best cure is to do something where you're reaching out to other people. I clearly thought then, and I think now, that I get far more out of this service than I put into it. The payoffs
right.
are just huge.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me then kind of how the Soupmobile began. You said it started out kind of with meager beginnings.
Yeah, it literally, I write in my book that it started on a wing and a lot of prayers. we literally had nothing, starting with no money, no donors, no supporters. We weren't under the umbrella of any church, or we didn't have a deep pocket donor. Everything you're not supposed to do when you're starting a charity, we did. We went totally against the grain. I didn't know it at the time, but you're not supposed to be. Conventional wisdom says that if you want to start a charity that's feeding the homeless, you better start under the umbrella of a large church, or you better have a very deep pocket donor. And mm-hmm. I didn't know that when we started. So we just kind of, with a lot of prayers and a lot of faith, started very, very slowly. Drawing volunteers on board, local food stores to donate food to us, getting people to even recognize who we were. Part of it was just getting the word out that, we're feeding the homeless now and we need help. But from those meager beginnings, God has just incredibly opened door after door for us.
Mm-hmm.
He's literally, for us, it's like parting the Red Seas. And I think the reason he does it, it just goes back to the Bible. I mean, Jesus said, feed my sheep. And now we think that means more than food, but nonetheless, he said, feed my sheep, and that's just what we're doing. And he seems to be honoring us for doing it by opening these doors for us. We've gone from that first year where we served 5,000 meals. Now we're serving over 150,000 meals per year. And to do that without a deep pocket donor or without being under the umbrella of a large church would seem almost impossible, but with God, all things are possible.
Mm-hmm. Now, what made you go with the mobile idea, the mobile soup kitchen versus, you know, a brick and mortar, everybody come to us and we'll feed you?
Well, we did that because of a concept called NIMBY. That's N-I-M-B-Y. It stands for not in my backyard.
Right.
Starting a soup kitchen in a neighborhood, or whether it's residential or a business neighborhood, nobody wants it in their backyard because a soup kitchen is going to draw in homeless people. Businesses, residential people, they don't want homeless people hanging around. So it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to get zoning to build and run a regular soup kitchen. Now, there are soup kitchens out there, but they're grandfathered in. They've been around for a long time. But in Dallas, to just build a soup kitchen, even if you have the money, it's not enough because you have to have the zoning permit, and you just can't get it. So, you know, I tossed and turned on this. I thought, geez, if I can't feed the homeless in a regular soup kitchen, what am I going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of prayer about it, and just boom, the thought came to me, and I know this had to be from the Lord, was, hey, if they can't come to you, why don't you go to them?
Mm-hmm.
And voila, the idea of a mobile soup kitchen was born, and that went from, okay, if I'm going to do a mobile soup kitchen, what am I going to call it? Well, I know we're going to be serving a lot of soup, so let's call it the Soupmobile. And that's how it was born, and that's how I got the nickname the Soup Man. You know, we're serving a lot of soup, and the mobile soup kitchen, the Soupmobile, and it just seemed like a natural fit.
Mm-hmm. I love the picture of basically what you're doing, is that you're actually going to the people and going to the need. It's very, to me, that's very incarnational. That's very much the Word became flesh and moved into the neighborhood.
Yes.
Because being mobile like you are, you can pack up and go where the people are. You can move into their neighborhood, and you're not expecting them. Like so many times, I think we expect the people to come to us as the church or come to us as a ministry. You know, you have to make it all the way to us, and then we'll help you. But you're literally reversing that and saying, no, I'm going to come to you because you matter enough that I'm willing to take my time to come to you.
Yeah, it's true. Jesus said, go out into the world. He didn't say, wait for the world to come to you. He said, go out into the world. And we're not just serving food. We're serving up a healthy dose of Christ when we go out.
Mm-hmm.
And we totally agree with what you're saying, this concept of let's show them that they are important enough, that we will come to them. And for the homeless, of course, they have so many other issues like transportation. They don't have transportation. They
mm-hmm.
might not be able to afford money to get on the bus to come to you if you had a regular soup kitchen. So we think this concept of going out into the world, going to them, fits perfectly with what we want to do.
Okay. Now, have you always, being known the soup man, were you always preparing the soup, preparing the meals and so forth? Or were you just the driver and got other volunteers to help with the cooking?
Well, in the early days, it was pretty much a one-man operation, me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, over the years, that has changed. Now I am surrounded by an army. I mean, a literal army of volunteers and donors and supporters and people that are praying for us. That these people are the heart and soul of the Soupmobile. They're what really makes it run. It's just gone far beyond that one-man operation. But in the early days, I was the chief cook and bottle washer. But strangely enough, here's a guy. I'm running this Soupmobile, this major charity feeding the homeless. I got this nickname, the Soup Man. But strangely enough, I'm not a very good cook. it's kind of ironic. You would think I would be a natural cook, but I'm not. And early on, when I was the cook, I'm not anymore, but when I was the cook, and doing a lot of other things, answering the phone, doing emails, fundraising. Sometimes I'd have a pot of food on the stove and cooking it up for that day's meal, and I'd be off busy answering the phone, and a lot of times the food would get burnt. And I'd come back, and I'd quickly stir it, and I'd try to throw some seasoning in to disguise the taste. And then when I'd go out and serve that food, you know, these homeless people, they would recognize, and they'd go, "Soup man, it looks like you burned the soup again today." I go, no, that's not burnt soup. I said, that's Cajun cooking.
Yeah. It's blackened chicken.
Yeah, after a while, the Cajun cooking became code for burnt. So now, and just show you how the Lord works, now my professional chef that volunteers here every day and cooks the food, he is actually from Louisiana, where they really do Cajun cooking, from New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And when he does Cajun cooking, I mean, it's the real thing. And so we joke all the time about my version of Cajun cooking, which is burnt, and his version, which is the real thing. And
mm-hmm.
clearly our homeless people prefer his, but it's been quite a journey getting me out of the kitchen and getting a professional in there. But in the early days, yeah, I was the chief cook and bottle washer, but again, the soup man's not the best cook, so I've got some other talents, but cooking's just not one of them.
Excellent. Well, now I know that in some of my experience with the homeless in Dallas, or the under-resourced, I think is a much better term. When we're out helping people, I know that we've run into some resistance from property owners, occasionally from the city. They don't like you gathering, you know, either on their property, or they don't like you gathering here. There's certain requirements for giving away food or serving food or whatever. Did you run into that from the beginning, or were people more receptive to your ideas?
Well, we have clearly had to navigate here a fine line to keep a lot of people happy. We had to keep the city happy. We had to keep where we were feeding the neighbors happy, the businesses. And what's worked out well for us is we have been very careful over the years to kind of pay our dues. We wouldn't just drive into a neighborhood and start serving. We would go in before we were serving and let people know who we were
mm-hmm.
In advance and what we were doing. And we also run what I call as a real tight ship. So when we're serving the homeless the meal, it's not just helter-skelter. I mean, we like in a movie, we got those movie ropes. We're keeping things well-organized. We're keeping things under control. And we've developed a reputation over the years for running a clean and a smooth operation. And then in Dallas, one of the biggest complaints over the years about anybody that's feeding anywhere has been the trash they leave behind.
Mm-hmm.
So we early on nipped that in the bud. When we're feeding, we have a full-time group of volunteers that has got trash bags in their hand going around picking up trash, and not only the trash that we bring, the cups and the plates that are left over, but we're picking up the trash that's there left from just in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
When we leave, our goal is to, when we're finished feeding, is to leave the place cleaner than when we found it. And again,
yeah.
Once that reputation spread that the soupmobile was literally taking care of business, that made a huge difference in the reception that we received. So we've just been very careful over the years just to do it cleaner and to do it better and to take the attitude that if we do it that way, if we run it right, we will be accepted, and that's what really has happened. We have,
mm-hmm.
We're very well accepted and have a really good reputation in the Dallas area.
Very good. Well, explain kind of what your average day is like there at the soup kitchen and the soupmobile.
Well, most days, when I say most days, we serve 150,000 meals a year now,
mm-hmm.
and it's the heart of the feeding is Monday through Friday, every weekday, year-round, even on holidays. If a holiday falls on a Monday through a Friday, we ignore the fact that it's a holiday. If you're homeless in Dallas and it's a Monday through a Friday, any weekday, you know, even if it's a holiday, the soupmobile is going to be there. Even if it's raining, we're going to be there. If there's a hurricane, we're going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. We're going to show up, and you're going to get your meal. So when we start our normal weekday, on a Monday morning, for example, our head chef is arriving about 8 a.m., and his assistants are arriving with him, and they are immediately starting to cook up a hot meal. It's a hot meal every day. It's a full, complete meal. And they're cooking from about 8 a.m. To 12 noon. And in that four-hour period, they're cooking up 600 hot, healthy, hearty meals. And at the same time, we have a whole other staff of people that are loading those meals into hot containers or cold, depending on what the food is, loading those onto our mobile vans so that shortly after 12 noon, we are literally in those vans driving into South Dallas where we're going on our to serve the homeless. And we set up, what we do is once we get to our location, we pull these long tables out of the back of the vans, and we put the food up on top of the tables, and the homeless come by, kind of like you would in a cafeteria, buffet style, and we serve them their food as they're walking down the line. And actually, the serving of the food itself goes pretty quickly. We can serve 600 meals in about an hour. It moves amazingly fast. We've over the years, kind of got the, we don't rush anybody, but it moves pretty quickly. And for the homeless, that's important because, particularly in Dallas, in the heat of the summer, you can get 110 degrees out there. You're waiting out in line. You want to get your food and get to that line as quickly as you can. So we keep it moving pretty fast. So once we're finished up with lunch and serving that lunchtime meal, 600 meals, then it's back to the Supermobile headquarters and, of course, clean up now. We've got to clean up all the containers and wash out the vans and everything because of the health department rules. You know, obviously with food, got to keep things really clean. And that's the heart of the feeding day, that 8 a.m. to around 2 p.m., 2:30 p.m., where we're serving, cooking, serving, and then cleaning up. The rest of our days are, we do a lot of work in the office. We're running a business. Even though it's a charity, we have to run it as a business. We have to file tax returns just like any other business. We're constantly on the lookout for donations and talking with our donors. So we're doing all the normal stuff you do in a normal office atmosphere, but we just added to it this concept of cooking and serving 600 meals a day. So we put in some pretty long days, but totally fruitful. We feel totally privileged that God allows us to do what we're doing. And I tell people that I have the best job on the, not in Dallas, not in the United States, I have the best job on the planet where I get to get up every day and I get to feed a sheep. It just doesn't get any better than that. So we feel really blessed and privileged we can do what we do.
Very good. Now, how many do you go to the same spot every day, or does it vary up from day to day?
In the early years, that's a good question. In the early years, we used to go to various spots. And we switched about 3 years ago to going to one spot. And the reason we did it was if you had a homeless person that was walking to one of the, like, five locations we used to go to, and missed that location, maybe got there a little bit late, and we'd already moved on, sometimes they would miss a meal because they couldn't get to the other location in time. So we decided to go to one central location, and that's worked out beautifully because now in Dallas, everybody knows to come to this location at this time, and you're going to get a meal no matter what. Even if you have to walk a little bit farther to get to that location, you know it's going to be there. You're not taking a chance that you'll miss one of our stops by 5 minutes and we're gone. And it's worked out beautifully for the homeless in Dallas. And just like any big city, there's a grapevine in homeless grapevine in Dallas where it's better than the internet. The word just spreads. So if a new homeless person comes into town, they say, geez, where can I get a meal? And they'll say, well, the Supermobile is serving here every day at this location. Just be there and you'll get your food. And sure enough, they do.
Okay. Now, do you have plans maybe in the future or dreams in the future of, you know, that's still, you're still coming to one location? Do you have ideas of going, maybe having four or five vans going out to different locations, or do you just hope to grow in that one area?
Well, there's certainly a lot of room for growth in that one area, but we started something in addition to our feeding that we think is going to really be our next big thrust, and it's called Supermobile Village. And we started this in October of 2009, so it's just a few months old. But what Soupmobile Village is, the concept is to have 100 group homes located all over the Dallas area, each group home holding up to 5 homeless people, and each group home being designed specifically to not only take a homeless person off the streets into this home, but to clean them up, get them a job, get them established, and then within about 6 months, transition them out of the group home back into regular society with a job, with their own place to live. And then as we kick them out of the nest after 6 months, move a new homeless person into their slot. And the goal here is to start to literally, we're going to keep feeding our 150,000 meals a year. That's not going to stop. But we want to start doing more than just giving them this concept of feeding them a fish. You give a man a fish, you feed him for a day.
Mm-hmm.
We want to teach these people, you know, how to fish.
Mm-hmm.
And literally bring them out of homelessness back into the community, working and paying taxes just like everybody else does.
Mm-hmm.
And so Soupmobile Village, this concept, will apply both to homeless men and homeless women. We opened our first home for men in October of 2009, and then in spring of 2010, in just a couple of months, we'll open up our first group home for homeless women. The goal, again, being to, we think it's great to feed them. It's very important, but we want to do more. We want to give them a chance to get back out of this pit that they've fallen
mm-hmm.
in. And as you know, if you're homeless, nobody wants to hire you. Nobody wants to house you. Just having the stigma of being homeless is a deal breaker for most employers. But coming through Soupmobile Village, where you've got a roof over your head, you have a phone where your employer can call, you have a transportation, might be a bus pass, but you've got transportation, then it's a whole different story. Then we can have a lot better chance of getting them a job and getting them gainfully employed. So this transition program of Soupmobile Village, we're pretty excited about it. So I think, in answer to your question, we'll clearly keep expanding our feeding program. The need is there. There's no question about it. But we want to add Soupmobile Village to our original feeding concept to do more than just feed.
Okay, very good. I don't know if you follow Mark Horvath, who does InvisiblePeople.tv, but I know that from his experience, what he shared with us on our podcast is that shelter is so vital, that so many times people put restrictions and say, well, you have to clean up, you have to get a job, you know, you have to get off drugs, so and so forth. They put all these requirements before they give them a home, but they said giving them a home is usually, or giving them a place to stay and a roof over their head is really usually what helps break that, the rest of that cycle. Trying to get them to break that cycle before giving them a shelter is really tough to do.
Yeah, and I think that's been a proven concept in many areas of the United States, where if you'll give them shelter first, then all the other things, as you said, will fall in place. It's a hard concept, though, for some people to grasp. They're more thinking of, you know, show me, get a job, get cleaned up, and then we'll talk about shelter. But it's really the opposite way around. They just don't have any ability to get cleaned up and to get a job without the shelter.
Right.
So it's clearly true, and it's been proven that it's a shelter-first concept that will make it work. And it does work. That's the beauty of it. This, what we're doing here in Dallas, it's a proven concept where if you go the shelter-first route, these people have a far greater chance of succeeding. It's not guaranteed for everybody, obviously, but it's a whole lot better chance than saying, you know, get that job and get cleaned up first, and then we'll give you shelter. So we're trying to do it in a way that we think gives these homeless people the best chance. And as you said, shelter first is the best way to do it.
And I'm so glad from my faith perspective that that's how God operates with me, that God didn't say, no, you need to get cleaned up first. No, you need to get your life in order first. I'm going to give you grace, and that through that grace, you'll learn how to get cleaned up. And so I think that that's a great illustration of what you're doing as well.
Absolutely. God takes us just as we are. Puts no conditions. He says, you know, come to my son, and you will be saved. And it's my goodness. I mean, I know totally When the Bible says we've all sinned and come short of the glory of God. And if we had to get past that sinner part to be saved, we'd never make it. So,
yeah.
So you're right. God is so incredibly generous, and we should be the same. And that's what we're trying to do with the Supermobile in reaching out to these people.
Now, you do a very cool thing that you've just wrapped up and are probably already planning for again. But each Christmas, you do something pretty unique on Christmas Eve. I'd love for you to share a little bit of it with our listeners about what that is.
It's a totally magical, total amazing project that we have. It's called our Christmas Angel Project. And we just finished up in December of 2009. We just finished up our fifth annual Christmas Angel Project. And what we do, we took 500 homeless men and women literally right off the streets of Dallas, and we put them up at the downtown Dallas Hyatt Regency Hotel for Christmas. They all get new clothes, they get fabulous gifts, and they get lots of love. We have a huge banquet that we hold in their honor in the Hyatt Ballroom. And most important is when they wake up on Christmas morning, it's not in some cardboard box under a bridge. It's in a nice, safe, warm bed at the Hyatt Regency Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
It is an astounding project here in Dallas. This year we had over 1,500 volunteers sign up to come down to the Hyatt to help us with the project, and we could have had over 2,000. We finally had to shut down the volunteer slot. There were so many people. It was amazing. And it's just becoming Christmas time in Dallas now. Coming to the Hyatt and helping us with the Christmas Angel Project has just become the thing to do. And it's got to the point where when people ask me about it, they say, David, well, tell me about the volunteer opportunity at the Hyatt at your Christmas Angel Project. And I'll say, well, in essence, it's not going to be the best volunteer opportunity that you'll have this year. It will be the best volunteer opportunity of your entire life.
Mm.
Because when you see the tears in the eyes of these homeless people and the smiles on their faces, it just, your heart, it just touches your heart in ways that are unimaginable. We've done this 5 years in a row, and I am just as deeply touched this year as I was the first year we did it.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that we can give these homeless people who have virtually nothing, with this magical Christmas that they will never forget. This will stay with them for their entire life. And as a bonus, this has just been a total bonus, is the volunteers that come, they are more touched by it, I think, than the homeless sometimes. I mean, they just come to me in droves after the event and just thanking me, saying, Soup Man, thank you for this just marvelous a volunteer opportunity. It's the best thing I've ever done. And we feel this is how God works. We're doing this Christmas Angel Project that's clearly blessing the homeless, but it's also blessing the volunteers. And I call that a win-win proposition where,
mm-hmm.
where God doesn't say, oh, you volunteered, you got to lose something here, to bless the homeless. He said, no. He said, you come and volunteer, and you'll be blessed for doing it, and the homeless will be blessed too. So to me, it's just another sign of God in action, just doing his thing.
Very good. Well, I want to give you a chance to talk just a little bit about your book. I'd hate to end the conversation without you giving a chance to kind of talk about it and plug it a little bit. The book is God on Vacation. Can you kind of give us a gist of it, of what you wrote?
Yes, the book really came out of my experiences with my late wife and the 15 years where we were literally nomads traveling the United States looking for her cure. But the book is so much more. It interweaves my story and her story. Then it interweaves the story of the Supermobile itself, how we literally started on just a wing and a lot of prayers. And then it talks about things like our how God has just opened the doors for us to keep increasing our operation year after year. It talks about our Christmas Angel Project. But the book, the title says it all. Is God on vacation? Now, I think we all know the answer to that God never goes on vacation. But in all of our lives, particularly I think if you're homeless, there got to be times you go, God, just where the heck are you? I'm hurting here. I'm in trouble. Things are going so badly for me or for my loved ones, and you don't seem to be around. You don't seem to be answering me. And that's how I felt a lot with when my wife got sick shortly after we got married. It's like, God, where the heck are you? And are you on vacation?
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like he was. Now, little did I know at the time that not only was he not on, he wasn't on vacation, he never went on vacation, but that he was working, I couldn't see it, but that didn't matter. He was working behind the scenes and making things happen. And that's what we try to show the homeless here, that even though things might look pretty bad for you right now, even though things aren't going very well for you right now, God is working on your behalf. And out of the midst of these troubling times, wonderful things can happen. The Bible says God works out all things together for the good. Even bad things, he works them out for the good. So that's kind of what this book is all about. It's about telling people that God is not on vacation. He's there, and even if you can't quite recognize it, he is there working on your behalf. And we feel like if we can take that attitude to our homeless people that we're serving, that it's not hopeless. You're not hopeless. Your situation, God is working on it. Then we feel like we've done our job. And the one hope I have, or prayer I think, for this book that I've written, is that if it does nothing more, if a person reads it, if it does nothing more than encourage them to do just one good act each day. It could be something as simple as putting a quarter in a parking meter for somebody where the meters are going red and saving them from a parking ticket. It could be opening the door for somebody. It could be walking across the street and just giving somebody a big smile. If people will just start to reach out to other people in just little tiny ways, and if this book will encourage them to do that and show them that God is not on vacation, then we've done our job here. And my hope and prayer for this book is that people that do read it will feel blessed by it, and they'll turn around and be a blessing to their fellow man. That's the goal.
Very good. Well, great words. You've got a great outreach, and we appreciate you really being the hands and feet of Christ to those around you, David. I appreciate all that you're doing in our area and inspiring people, not only in our area, but around the world through what you're doing.
Well, thank you. It's been my total pleasure.
And if people want to donate or anything, there's definitely a link there on your website, soupmobile.org, also a volunteer sign up. And you're on Facebook, I see, as well.
Yes.
Any other ways that people can get in touch with you or that you'd like to pass along?
Yeah, the best way to get a hold of us and to learn more about us is the website, soupmobile.org, O-R-G.
Mm-hmm.
That has all the information, all the links, and it's just the easiest way to contact us and to learn more about us.
Very good. Well, David, we appreciate your time. We appreciate what you're doing, and pray that God will continue to bless you as you bless others.
Thank you kindly.
Well, have a great day, and we look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you.
Got nothing in my hands to part these waves. Got nothing in my bank account that saves. Got no more might left to muscle through. But oh, I've got you. I've got you. Got demons gathered round. It up. Spreading doubts aplenty, I can't drink this cup. Got no one left, the things I'll make it through. Thank you. Got a prayer that they'll come back around my way. You've got me, and oh, that gets me through.
If you have any questions or comments about this show, we do encourage you to drop us a line. You can email us somethingbeautifulpodcast@gmail.com or call our listener line 972-535-8980, 972-535-8980, or anywhere in the world if you're on Skype, simply Skype JD Blundell, and you can find a link to that right on our podcast page at www.somethingbeautifulpodcast.com.
Imagine your entire city destroyed in a moment. When a catastrophic earthquake hit Port-au-Prince, Haiti, that nightmare became a reality for hundreds of thousands of children. At least a third of the more than 65,000 Compassion-sponsored children live in the areas that were hardest hit. We anticipate thousands will have lost everything, and many of our church-based child development centers will have been destroyed. Compassion is working quickly to provide food, water, medical care, shelter, and counseling. We need your donation today. Please reach out in the name of Jesus to bring relief and comfort to precious children and their families whose lives have been devastated. Go to compassion.com to make your gift, or text the word disaster to 90999 to give $10 right now.
Thanks for listening to the Something Beautiful podcast. Join us again next week at somethingbeautifulpodcast.com.